The Gamer's Haven at gamershavenpodcast.com and Vorpal Network at vorpalnetwork.com are proud to present coverage of Gen Con 2010.
It's game time.
Quiet, please. I am analyzing.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Is the next step the transplantation of the human brain?
Ballsy. Stupid, but ballsy.
Stand by for action.
Welcome to the party, pal.
Okay.
Remember, we're not dealing with an intelligence on our own level.
Bring in the logic probe!
Ooh!
End of line.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. Huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com. Or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
This is the Vorpal Network.
The Hamlet's Hit Points Seminar. I'm Robin Laws, author of Hamlet's Hit Points. This is Jeff Tidball. This is Will Hindmarch. Among their many other sundry accomplishments, they are the brain and logistics trust behind GamePlayright.net. Before we get, I guess, into the content and thesis in the book, I thought I'd throw to you guys to tell us a little bit about GamePlayright and plug the Enterprise and your other exciting publications.
Sweet. So, do you want to, or shall I jump in?
Go ahead.
So, Will and I have been doing Gameplay Right for about 3 years. The idea was to start to see if we were interested in working together on a bunch of stuff. But we are both interested in kind of theory and practice of game design, and specifically where stories and games meet. And there's not a lot of people. There are a lot of people talking about that for sure on ye olde interwebs, but not publishing stuff. And so that's sort of where we saw a niche was at and wanted to go after it. And so when Robin was doing the Hamlet analysis on his live journal and got done with it, we were like, well, that should be a book, and that's obviously in the vein of what we're doing. And so we were all, let's do that.
And
he was, I consent to that.
Yes. Yet another group of people fell prey to one of my sinister plans. So, Hamlet's Hit Points is an analysis of three classic narratives. Yes, please do. And it analyzes them in a way that is useful and insightful, I hope, for role-playing gamers. And in order to analyze them in a way that was useful for role-playing gamers, it became necessary to create a new mode of analysis in order to look at stories, because we're looking at something different than you're looking at if you're trying to learn how to write a screenplay or a novel, or whether you're a literary critic or whether you're an English major. We are all looking at different things in stories, and so although I took and imported some story analysis techniques, particularly from theater and improv, basically we needed to find a new way that made sense to the very crunchy gamer mind of taking what seems like sort of airy, fairy, kind of mystical, vague storytelling principles and learning to break them down into the constituent techniques that storytellers use. Before I go any further, I'd just like to get a sense of the room and where we're at. So how many people are here because they've seen the book already? And how many people are followed the analysis on my blog? Okay. How many people are just interested in general in story and role-playing? And how many people accidentally wandered in thinking we're going to do a stat block for Hamlet? Okay, there we go. Okay, so story entered role-playing by accident. Back in the day, 30-plus years ago, when Dave and Gary were creating the games that shortly turned into Dungeons & Dragons and therefore turned into tabletop role-playing games as we know it, they were not intending to create a new storytelling form. They were trying to create a new form of war game in which the unit size shrank down from a platoon to one dude. And so basically that was the guy in a funny hat paradigm of gaming. And so instead of a panzer unit, it's a wizard with a hat and he's going through a dungeon. Or another one of the early games that sort of fed into role-playing game was a game that Dave Arneson had called the, I think it's called the Highway Patrol game, and there was a map of one of the square Midwestern states and you were a police officer chasing bank robbers around the state. And again, it was very simple change. It was just, okay, it's just you're playing this one guy. And the Rubicon that they crossed that turned what was essentially a war game into a storytelling form was when you decided that that guy would survive from one game to another and he would have a series of recurring adventures that he entered into. So the idea of experience, character progression, what I call persistence, turned that playing piece into a fictional character. And once you've got a fictional character, whether you know it or not, whether you're ready for it or not, you've got fiction. And because fiction entered through the back door of role-playing, because it entered accidentally, there was never any point where anyone sat down and analyzed how stories work the way that we analyzed encumbrance and, you know, weapon reach, and or analyzed even, like, we analyze things in stories, like, okay, well, Jack Vance has this magic system where the magicians cast a spell once and they forget it, and that seems like a kind of cool way to have a constraint on magic, because we can tell from the all the stories we've read that the story logic is that magic is very powerful, so we have to control it, meaning that we've been simulating things that we read about in fiction from the jump, but again, we haven't really been looking at how fiction works and what we expect from fiction. And because we are creating stories, whether we like it or not, and because stories are very powerful, they're deeply imprinted in us. The story tradition in Western culture goes back to the first myths that people told. Was codified more with the ancient Greek playwrights, and it's ingrained in us. And never in human history has it been more ingrained in us than in the modern media era, where people are constantly drowned in narrative, whether it be television shows, movies, comics, or even the news stories, these supposedly non-fictional things that we look at. And not just in terms of, oh, all the news is a lie, man, but in terms of news is always packaged as a narrative, as a story. And so, and even when you're asleep at night, your brain is generating narrative when you dream. It's taking all sorts of disparate signals and thoughts that are bubbling up from your unconscious and trying to make sense of them, because basically what happens when you dream is that you're, all of your sensory apparatus is still active, but you've got no sensory input, and your brain has to create some or it short circuits. And so it gives you all this sensory input and then you have to figure out what to do with it and you turn it into a narrative. And what's not even clear necessarily yet is to what extent the narratives that we create in dreams affected the way films are edited, or the way that films are edited has changed the way we dream. But at any way, at an incredibly deep level, story is ingrained in all of us, but it's something we don't necessarily think of or we react to unconsciously or instinctively, but we know when a story goes wrong. We know when a story disappoints us. So in role-playing, when if you're just looking only at the question of what world does my game simulate, what are the logical things that would happen in this game given the physical reality that I've chosen to simulate, often you will end up, even if you're really super interested in that sort of thought experiment of simulating a world, and not that there's anything wrong with that, except you may end up having results at the end of the day, even though everybody at the table is a committed simulationist who's like, I just want a sandbox world, I just want to see what happens, don't want to have a tilt on the scales at all. At the end of the day, things will happen in the story that may disappoint you on an emotional level, and you may walk away feeling unsatisfied because the story didn't have the story elements that we've been trained to look for and are deeply emotionally keyed into. So basically what this book sets out to do is to take a really simple, obvious, dead obvious fact about narrative that we have ignored because we haven't thought about it, and try to import it into the way we look at games. And that simple, dead, obvious fact is that stories affect our emotions. They're meant to affect our emotions, and they're most powerful when the way they affect our emotions has a rhythm to it. And almost any story, from the simplest to the most complicated, moves you on an arc between hope, what you hope will happen for the characters you identify with, and fear, what you fear will happen to them if things go wrong, if they fail at their objectives. And so Hamlet's Hit Points maps out Hamlet, Casablanca, and the film version of Dr. No, beat by beat, moment by moment, tracking the emotional shifts that the storytellers put you through as you experience those stories. And the thing that you learn really rapidly is that a well-told, compelling story is continually moving you between hope and fear, hope and fear, hope and fear. It's not necessarily a predictable rhythm. It's not like you can scientifically studied narratives and say, okay, well, it's always three for two, three up, two down. It shouldn't be predictable. That's part of what makes a compelling story. And one point I want to make is that when we're analyzing stories, stories are not science, they're alchemy. But you do need to analyze them in order to understand them, in order to analyze the stories you're telling and make them more interesting and more compelling, but you can't get trapped in an idea of there being only one interpretation, only one way to look at stories. And the system I'm creating, I'm not arguing that this is the only possible way that you can look at stories. If any two people even just took this system and applied them to the same stories, they would interpret some beats differently, they would ignore others. And it's not the point to be absolutely right on some objective scale about how a story maps out precisely, but to just think about those issues and engage with them so that that becomes ingrained in you while you're running a role-playing game or while you're playing a role-playing game, because everybody at the table is contributing to the story. If you're a player, you actually have, in a lot of ways, more influence over the outcome of the story than the GM does, because you have the main characters, you have the identification figures, you have the protagonist, you're driving the story. And another sort of tangential point I'd like to make is a lot of people worry when you talk about story in role-playing games because they're afraid of being railroaded. They're the idea that I'm talking about narrative structure freaks some people out because they've had uncollaborative GMs who've tried to impose a story on them, and nothing they do or decide to do in the course of their game changes the outcome of that story. And so if you've had that bad experience, you think of story structure as something that the GM has imposed on you. And in fact, what I'm hoping to do with this book is to show that structure is not the most important thing for role-playing to worry about. Structure will take care of itself over time and is something for everybody to contribute to. It's about story making, not storytelling. And that's why I concentrate on these little beats, these little moments, and not so much coming to a big outcome, but knowing where you are in any given moment and what's going on and where the emotional arrow is pointing. Excuse me.
Okay, so late. Still needs one of these. I'll give you a quick minute to have a drink or whatever. Anyone?
So basically what I've done is, while analyzing these stories, come to the understanding that there are types of narrative beats. And a beat, in this case, is just any distinct moment in the storyline that changes the emotional direction. There are different ways to analyze, you know, everybody looking at a story will find a different set of beats. You can break things down into tiny little micro beats, for example. Actors, when they prepare to perform a scene, will go through like a lot, you know, three or four lines of dialogue and may find three or four different emotional shifts in a short speech. Or in a monologue, they may find 20 or 25. Well, I don't drill down to that level because it would be interminable and it's not, you know, really the point. And so I'm looking more at sort of bigger moments. The two main types of beats in any story are the procedural beat and the dramatic beat. In role-playing gaming, traditionally, we are mostly concerned with the procedural beat. And that is just a moment where the character we identify with, the protagonist, in a lot of stories that can sort of shift at times, as you know, we can suddenly identify with a different character. We may identify with only one character. Often we identify with a group of sympathetic characters. But the character who's the focus of that scene is trying to achieve something practical, something physical in the real world. So it's an external goal. And so when you are trying to find a secret door, when you're fighting a guy, when you're hanging off the edge of a car as people shoot at you, you are engaged in a procedural beat. You're going through a procedure to achieve an outward practical goal. And so Dr. No, for example, is a procedural narrative because almost all of its moments are devoted not to Bond's interior life, his emotional goals. There's a little bit at the end where, you know, he's getting together with the Ursula Andress character, Honey Rider, and there's a little bit of an emotional curve that Bond undergoes, but that really quickly hooks back into his main procedural goal, which is to investigate the murder of Strangways and uncover Dr. No's plot and foil it. So procedural beats are what we usually do, and don't really in a lot of games go into dramatic beats at all. And so if you just have a game where you're just trying to overcome an external goal, it's a procedural narrative. Dramatic beats are internal. You are trying to achieve an emotional goal that changes you somehow on the inside or changes your relationship to other people. Those moments are the ones that are sort of touching or sentimental. And Casablanca, for example, although there is a kind of a spy theme and subplot running through it, is almost exclusively a dramatic narrative because it's all about Rick Blaine's transformation from being a wounded, damaged guy after losing Ingrid Bergman coming back out to a guy who's engaged with the world and who becomes altruistic again. And all of the beats around that revolve around the relationship between the Humphrey Bogart character Rick and the Ingrid Bergman character Elsa. So it's primarily a dramatic narrative, or Glengarry Glen Ross is a dramatic narrative, or There Will Be Blood. Long Day's Journey Into Night. Hamlet is both. It's about 50-50 between being a mystery revenge story. The ghost says to Hamlet, avenge my death, and Hamlet has to prove that what the ghost is telling him is correct, and then take action. And then half of it is his emotional response to having this horrible responsibility foisted on him, and how that changes his relationships to the people around him, his mother, Ophelia. And so a story that's predominantly dramatic beats is dramatic story that's predominantly procedural beats is a procedural story. And so those are the two big bread and butter beats. Almost all the beats in any story will be one or other or kind of both. There are other minor beats. There's a commentary beats where the author is giving you an indication of what's the meaning of the story is, but it doesn't really advance the narrative or change the character situation. There's the anticipation beat where you're sort of told up front that something cool is going to happen later, so it sets up a two-point emotional response. So that's where, you know, Ripley comes out with a power loader and says,
whatever it is.
Get away from her, you bitch.
Get away from her, you bitch. You know, Popeye has eaten his spinach. Somebody, Bruce Banner, said, you're not going to like me when I'm mad. And everybody, said, oh, I think I would like you when you're mad. Boom. And, that moment where he comes over and his eyes turn green, that's an anticipation beat because you know that all of the vicarious suffering you've undergone with Bruce Banner as he's been getting the crap kicked out of him is now about to be reversed and the bad guys are going to get a thumping. There are two sort of free-floating beats where the change... yes?
Would that be a smashing?
You're right. I stand corrected.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
You're right. That's absolutely correct, sir. There's a couple of beats where storytellers will change the emotional tenor without actually changing the situation for the characters. A beat that makes you feel better without really advancing the story is a gratification beat. So that can be like a musical number or a shot of beautiful scenery or some sort of musical break. And the opposite of that is the bring down. Which are kind of rare and hard to find a lot of times. But any scene where, your lead character has just got fired and he comes out of his office and a car comes by and gratuitously splashes him, or any scene where a pigeon poops on a dude, that's almost always like a gratuitous bring down scene. Yes?
I was going to ask, with the procedural and the dramatic, how do you differentiate between, say, me talking to someone as an external force and trying to change their emotion versus the dramatic actually having a connection?
The difference in interaction scenes and dialogue scenes would comes from what is the goal of the scene. So if I'm trying to get information from you that advances my practical goal, and I don't really care that I've changed your emotional state, I'm just doing it in order to achieve that goal, it's probably a procedural scene. So, for example, an interrogation scene in a cop show, the cops have to upset somebody in order to get information out of them, but that's just, the goal is not to upset them, that's the means to the goal. Whereas, if the police, at the end of the day, when the police officer comes home and has to deal with his girlfriend, and they have an argument, he's not trying to achieve a practical goal, he's trying to change his own emotional state or the other character's emotional state. And then finally we get to the three big informational beats. And a lot of stories develop according to how they set out information. And information is a huge, huge issue in role-playing because everything is verbal. We don't have music, we don't have... acting, we don't have visuals. So in a way, everything that happens in a role-playing game is us conveying information to each other as sort of the collective audience. And there's emotional satisfaction in getting information, getting exposition, whether it's in a role-playing game or in traditional media, if that has been set up for us. So if the first type of information beat is the question. It introduces a question. And that can be, you walk into a room and there's a guy lying dead on the floor. Well, what happened? What's going on? And so as soon as you feel that, that tips you downwards emotionally because you're anxious, there's disorder in the world, there's something you don't understand. And then when you discover a little bit more, it gives you a sense of calm and satisfaction, happiness as you learn more about the story and you become reoriented and the world seems more orderly. And so when you learn something, that's called a reveal. So you've got your question and your reveal. And sometimes you will often get information where there's no immediate apparent emotional context for it, but you need it later to understand what's going on in the story. So in Ocean's 11, for example, when they show them building the practice bank vault, Now, the practice bank vault is not really a practice bank vault at all. It's a mock bank vault that they're going to use to create a video feed later on.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. That's also a moment of misdirection, but it's... So when you're given information initially in a way where you're not supposed to quite figure out how it fits, that's called a pipe beat, and that comes from screenwriting jargon where they refer to those moments of certain hidden exposition as laying pipe, and which is something that's akin to being a plumber. So basically those are the items that make up a narrative map when you analyze these three narratives, or when you take this system away and use them to analyze either a movie when you want to understand what was really awesome about it so you can replicate it in your games, or when you leave something that you thought was going to be great and you're disappointed, you can start to, oh, well, wait, okay, well, the problem was there was this big chunk in the middle where there's just all of this dead exposition that didn't make...
Old beats of laying pipe.
Right, that didn't make me crave... information. So I disengaged with the narrative. So basically, what this book does is just presents a way of looking at stories. And as an example, there's the famous scene with Bond and the tarantula in Dr. No, where he goes back to his hotel room. He enters his hotel room and he realizes that there's signs of intrusion, that somebody's been in his hotel room. And initially, as soon as we realize that, we might be cued to be anxious, but in fact, what the film does is that makes that moment a moment of power for Bond, because the audience may be anxious for him, but Bond remains really cool under pressure, and they play the Bond theme, ding, 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 ding. And so it's like, and in the early Bond films, there's a lot of scenes where Bond is just hanging around in his hotel room with the music, ding, 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 ding. And, you know, depending on what era of Bond is, it's still sort of compelling because of the charisma and the music and everything. And so... he keeps cool, so that's a procedural beat, right? If there's nothing emotional at stake for Bond, in fact, that's the whole point of being Bond, there's never anything emotionally at stake, really. Because you are, you know, you are dominant. You're the dominant figure who dominates everyone in the narrative except M occasionally, who will, you know, bust your balls a little at the beginning. So he's cool, so we feel cool, so the procedural beat and the arrow points up. But then... the facade cracks just a little, and it's just a fleeting moment, which I never registered before I analyzed the film for the book, and it's one of my favorite films, where he sits down and he puts a cold glass to his forehead, and it's just one of the very few instances of vulnerability for Bond in the whole movie, or probably the whole Sean Connery canon. I mean, now he's all emotional and stuff because he's not Bond anymore, but that's a different question. And so that... little cue that there is something under Bond and that he is actually worried then gives us a down emotional note. And so the next big beat is when he discovers the tarantula crawling up on him. And of course that's a tarantula! And so that moment of fear and, you know, in the 1962, you know, now kids, any kid watching it today, well, the tarantula is actually no threat to humans. But at the time, you're, oh my God, it's a tarantula. And in fact, the tarantula is, there's big pipe laid for the tarantula earlier. There's a big unveiling of the tarantula. Mm-hmm. And you, oh my God, they're going to send a tarantula after him. But the scene still plays because it's shot so well and Connery really supersells the tension and nervous fear and stillness of realizing that the tarantula is there. But it's not a big sequence that goes up and down where there's a roller coaster ride of is the tarantula winning, is Bond winning. He just sort of waits and then boom, he whips him off with the sheet and crushes the tarantula. And so that's a big up note. And so that's basically how you analyze a moment and look for those ups and downs in a narrative. And so... the purpose of this in role-playing terms, and throughout the book there's all kinds of sidebars and asides for any given moment on how would this play in a role-playing game? How would a role-playing game be different than a story? What expectations would you have if Bond was a player character or Hamlet was a character, player character? And what does this tell us about ideas and techniques that we can sneak into our games in terms of, you know, creating characters who act as foils for other characters, or so on and so forth. But basically the idea is to ultimately look at our own stories, whether it's just the bare outlines of a possible story, which is a scenario that you create, or the actual story, which is the story that everybody creates together sitting at the gaming table. So you can use that for scenario design. You can use that afterwards to go, well, everybody was kind of bored that game, and they weren't really engaged. Did I move the arrow up and down enough? Or, you know, they kept winning all of the, this is a problem I have in my own games, is quite often the characters will win all of the actual procedural contests that they undergo using the game mechanics, but they'll still be really depressed and down and feel that they're losing, or feel that their characters are losers. And that's because they have this sort of, they've created this ongoing paradigm that, you know, their characters are a bunch of schmucks in whatever game they run, and they're a bunch of losers and failures. And it's like, but wait, you aren't paying attention to what's actually going on in the story. You're creating this other narrative of failure and incompetence.
Good work, gamer.
Yes, exactly. And so, as weird as that is, it is a tip-off that, oh, wait a minute, they're perceiving this different. Their emotional arrows don't map the way that it would map if you just paid attention to what they were actually accomplishing. So, for example, a player argument about what to do next, where they get frustrated with each other, isn't part of the story at all, but it's part of the emotional journey that happens in the room that day. And so when you see that happening, traditionally the sort of oral history tradition of role-playing says, well, the GM, you know, that's hands-off time when the players are conferring. But if you see that everybody's getting bummed out with each other and frustrated, and it's just, you know, they're in their own real-life dramatic moments where they're all trying to, you know, get something emotional out of each other, and they're not really dealing with the situation, or they're not seeing eye to eye or whatever, you can either intervene, or which I actually recommend, or you can do things in the story to make sure that overtly awesome things happen to them that reestablish their sense of power and dominance and mastery, the things that they came to the table to experience. So it's a matter of tracking the real life emotions at the table as well as the emotions of the characters. And then finally, you can, although this is not primarily addressed to writers of fiction, whether that be for screenwriting or TV or prose fiction, I actually write better outlines now that I've created this system, and I actually design my outlines graphically. For example, I'm writing a novel for Paizo for their Pathfinder line, and the first thing I did was I made a narrative map of all the story points, and then I wrote out the outline in typical prose form to send to my editor, and that way I could see that there were enough up and down scenes and it had enough emotional variation in it, and it allowed me to track other things as well. But I found that a useful tool too. So if you are also a writer or an aspiring writer, you may find things that you can adapt to this. So I've monologued for way too long, like a Bond villain. I've revealed my fiendish plan. So
escape from the trap already.
Exactly. So I think it's about time that we threw this open to questions and comments.
I just have a question about the materials you used to analyze with, and I'm wondering how your analysis might have been different if you had chosen. Because everything you chose was dramatic. You have Hamlet, dramatic tragedy, Casablanca, romance, and dramatic action in Dr. No. What if you had chosen Merry Wives of Windsor, Arsenic and Old Lace, and Blazing Saddles? And would that have changed anything?
It would have changed something, that's for sure. And, you know, once we make $1 million with this one, we can go back and do the one that analyzes a comedy and a horror story will probably be different.
Hamlet's Hit Points 2, this time it's personal?
Yes, yes. Hamlet's Hit Points 2, the Hamleting. In a comedy, you've actually got a weird sort of double function where you are both identifying with the character's plight and laughing at it at the same time.
Also.
Right. And so, or, you know, when... And there are different kinds of laughs, too, right? So that when the Charlie Chaplin slips on a banana peel, that's funny, but also sort of... But it's funny because it's awful and human, and you identify with that. So it's a generous laugh that makes you feel both bad for Charlie Chaplin and for yourself. When the bully police officer who's chasing Charlie Chaplin slips on the banana field, that's just flat out funny, and you feel a sense of power, and you feel that he's received his comeuppance.
The reason why I ask the question is because it seems like a lot of role-playing stories become stale because they're so dependent on the dramatic action story, the dramatic fantasy action story, and there are these other sides to it. I rarely see comedy come out in games that I end up playing in any way other than a side jokes.
Right. To plug another product, you might want to look at Skullduggery, which is my new game for the show, which is all about creating funny inter-player conflict. And it's designed for comedy. But basically, in order to make a comedy work, you make things get worse and worse and worse and worse for the characters until they suddenly get better at the end. And you may actually have more failure and more setbacks in comedy. Probably comedy and horror actually track probably fairly closely, oddly enough, because they're both about failure in a way that more traditional procedural narratives like Dr. No aren't. I think you had a question? Yes.
Yeah. As far as you know, are you the first one to come up with this method of analyzing stories?
I've drawn on some elements of other story analysis, for example, the way actors study scenes from a book called Audition by Michael Shurtleff. But basically, this system is my fault, so no one else can be blamed for this. I think you had a question?
I was actually going to say, I recently found out about a really fringe early trial beta. It's called a Geiger counter. And one of the appeals of Geiger counter specifically is that your characters are in these awful, terrible situations, much like horror films. I mean, it's supposed to be, you know, themed like old school, you know, space invasions where things just keep getting worse and worse. But rather than investing yourself emotionally in the characters, this game encourages you to kind of be as reckless as possible and possibly come up with the most inventive ways for your characters to die, because unless characters die with the way the engine works, nobody wins. And in that way, it follows those sort of it actually amplifies the beats in that way, because when a character does, you know, die, yeah, sure, there's this downbeat when the character dies, but there's also an empowerment because you know that your character's part of the survivors.
Right, so it's a crossed arrow emotionally, because the character is screwed, but the player has entered a more advantageous position.
Right.
And you also get the phenomenon of, you know, Call of Cthulhu, where we had a great Call of Cthulhu game. We all got driven insane and raped by monsters, and my brain exploded. That was great! Let's do it again! And so again, that's where, you know, it's a different a more complicated form of catharsis. And sometimes, you know, as you go through the book, you'll see there are some moments which, you know, emotionally cross each other, which are ambiguous moments. And often those are the moments that are the most compelling moments that you really remember. So at the end of Casablanca, when the, you know, the romantic confrontation between the two leads is coming to a head, there's a ton of ambiguous crossed arrows, because after all, life is an ambiguous crossed arrow.
Ooh.
Strike it going.
Yes.
So now that you know the different components, have you worked out a formula of what makes, you know, this is the foolproof way of keep people's attention?
The foolproof way is just to vary it, make sure that there's a lot of variance, and to make it unpredictable. So by definition, any formula that can be identified by the people experiencing it as a failure, because it knocks you out of the story. But just but if you tend to look at things that you find disappointing or boring or dull, you will find either, well, first of all, a story just might not be well executed, right? It might be, if it's a movie, it might be terribly acted and you know, predictably written. But it also, if there's something that is kind of compelling but doesn't quite work, it's often because it's just sort of downbeat after downbeat after downbeat, or upbeat after upbeat, or stuff that just doesn't go anywhere, that doesn't connect to the narrative and doesn't really gratify or horrify you or whatever. So I really want to emphasize it's alchemy, not science, and it's more about the process of thinking about it than it is about coming up with a foolproof result at the end.
So have you tried with your slumpy players who always feel like they're losing? Have you tried, like,
doing these things and sort of like trying to put in these emotional upbeats for them?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things I've learned from this is that failure is overrated, that in role-playing games, in most role-playing systems, you fail way more than you would fail in an equivalent narrative. And you know, there's failures in any procedural. Even, you know, Bond makes a big mistake near the end where he, you know, decides he's going to be, oh, don't worry, we'll be safe in the villain's lair. You know, it's nicely furnished. They're not going to gas us in the night. So what I try to do practically now is, first of all, remind them that they're, you know, fallen into this spiral again. But also to create scenes that just exist in order to remind them that their characters are awesome. So set up situations that, where they can easily overcome the opposition. For example, in D&D, we're encouraged to only have fights that are tuned for the character's level. And that means that, you know, after an hour of combat, you will, you know, eke out a victory against the other guys. Well, that means that the characters forget that actually, compared to everybody else in the world, if they're like 13th level or something, they're incredibly kick-ass. So the thing to do there is to have them run into a bunch of guards where you just, okay, so we attack them. Okay, you beat them. And describe it really vividly, so it's not just a throwaway moment, but it's like, you know, remind them how badass they are. Give them little, and you find in any story, there's a bunch of moments in Dr. No that only exist to show you how extraordinarily awesome Bond is. So the lesson is Bond it up.
There's a really brilliant example of that in the very first Mass Effect. About halfway through the game, all the characters are on this experimental laboratory, and there's these terrible, evil, resurrected aliens that have been taking over the space station, and it's occupied by these just, you know, barely well-trained guards who, you know, get creamed as soon as you walked in. I mean, these things come out of the vents and start killing them off, and your character comes in and literally saves the day. And in most situations where that would normally, like in a film or anything, you'd kind of be saying, oh, that's predictable. In this situation, because you get to control your reaction to how those people are trained. I mean, your character has the option of going, I can't believe you didn't train. You're meant to deal with this situation. Why do I have to cover for you? Or you can, you know, support them and back them up. And in role-playing games, that actually, I think, sort of helps the storyline.
If you read the book, would you also recommend reading the live journal analysis, or is it pretty much all conveyed in the book?
Follow the live journal to see new stuff and new insights, but you don't need to go back through Hamlet, because the Hamlet analysis, I discovered this system going through it. So, I suppose if you're really fascinated by the whole process, you could go back and see how initially I started out in a different direction, where I was interested in where the branch points were in the narrative and how they might have branched if it was a role-playing story. And quickly I learned that that wasn't what I was interested in at all, and that's how I sort of stumbled more into this. So the version in the book is a revised version based on how I came to understand the system by exploring it.
One thing that seems to come is a lot of stories have a protagonist. And most RPGs don't have a protagonist. They have a large team of protagonists,
right,
who all have very different goals. And it can sometimes, I find, be hard to get everyone involved in a single, especially with something emotional, get people involved in that. What sort of methods can you use, or is there any sort of hint of how you can kind of pull people in to other dramatic beats or procedural beats, even if they're not directly involved? Some players love to do that. They'll just jump in, and that's great. But
right.
Some people are just like, I'm not doing anything. I'm going to open up my Game Boy and start playing. And it's really hard to maintain anything like that.
It is hard to maintain, and it's getting harder and harder as the social conventions change around the whole issue of internet distractions. So now, you know, it's no longer rude to pull out your phone and start we would like to say so, but unfortunately, the idea of having of multitasking while you're interacting with other people is becoming increasingly prevalent. So it is difficult, and one thing to do is sort of accept that we're now living in a multitasking world where, you know, you haven't failed if someone is checking out for 2 minutes and then it's going to come back, as long as, you know, by the end of the evening, everybody is engaged in some way. Because you can fall into the pitfall of trying so hard to rope people in emotionally when they're not actually looking to be roped in emotionally. And, you know, it's like the old saying about, you know, teaching a pig to dance is, you know, has no effect and the pig doesn't learn to dance.
Where you can buy a hammer and hang it behind the GM's chair?
Yes, there is always threats of physical violence at the end of the day.
So have you had a chance now with the Beat system to look at some of the like more classic or famous published adventures for RPG settings and see if you can apply the same analysis?
I have yet to do that, and there's also the question of a scenario is not actually the story, it's just a blueprint for the story. And so you can sort of go through and you can find the choke points, you can find the branch points, but until you actually play it, right, you know, Tomb of Horrors has a different map depending on what, you know, how you go through the physical dungeon map changes the emotional map. It's like, you know, at what point do you hit the stupid frickin' fear of annihilation, right? Where you go, you know, how far do you go before you throw down the map in anger and attack your GM physically? Making you run through this antiquated...
wresting his hammer from him and
bludgeoning
him.
I was just curious, when you were talking about the piezo novel, do you have any plans to like share that? You were talking about the process where you did a flowchart and then like narrative you said, it'd be interesting to like be able to read that or see the process of that, because sometimes it's difficult to go from the beginning to the end story.
The problem with that, of course, is spoilers, right? As soon as
not ahead of time, it may be post, even.
Well, but at what point have enough people read my brilliant novel that I can then spoil them? And the problem with that one in particular is it's actually a fantasy heist novel, speaking about laying pipe and the difficulties of that. So it's, you know, it has to be really intricately plotted. So I would love someday to, I mean, maybe it would be worth doing to just write a piece of fiction specifically for that purpose and then analyze it, but I would have to find a way to be richly remunerated for that, which I'll work on that and find a business model.
Just a follow-up to that, actually. I'm curious, from a practical level, how did you map out the story beats for the...
I use actually a piece of mapping software called Campaign Cartographer from Pro Fantasy Software, which is basically a CAD program that's gamer friendly, and it's used obviously mostly for making maps, but it's also perfect for this purpose because it's about moving little units around in the on the field, and so it's perfect to be a virtual corkboard for outlining purposes, and you can move stuff around on the map without. You know, if you see a mistake, as often, you know, when I was going through this, I was in the, you know, would find that, oh no, I left out beat 78, and so you have to move all the stuff through the map, and it can be infinitely long if it's only a computer file, so you can scroll through it. So, actually what we're going to do is we're going to make available the icons and the arrows and everything through a Creative Commons license, so that you can download them and use them when making your own maps, whether you're using Campaign Cartographer, or whether using Photoshop or Draw.
Yeah,
or
so the book was laid out in InDesign, obviously, and that's how these were put together. Omnigraph would be a fantastic piece of software to use on this if you're on a Mac. Omni Software makes that. But the we'll release the graphics, like Robin said, under a Creative Commons license, and they'll be straight up vector files that you can import into whatever will deal with them and map this out. Or, you know, and map out your own stuff and use it for whatever.
Not knowing Dr. No nearly as well as I should for someone who claims to like Bond. Is that movie one of the ones where there is one of the villain's henchmen seemingly with Bond, or one of the women is with the person with the henchmen? Because one of the issues of the story that seems to also affect parties, at least a lot of the parties that I play in, is that everyone in the party is a hero. How does the story change when the hero is forced to put up with a villain that he may or may not know is the villain, which happens with Bond, and to some extent happens with Polonius and Hamlet, who I cheer when he gets stabbed through the curtain.
Right, yes. Let me see how to break that. Yeah, I think what you would need to do in order to replicate that in a gaming situation is you would have to collude with one of the players to be a ringer and say, okay, we're going to have this, and you obviously want to contain this to a thing, so let's have a little mini campaign, and you would say, okay, here's the character that you're going to present to the rest of the group, and here's who you really are, and here's your real agenda. And when I go like this, you pull out the sword and betray them at the end. Although, actually, the other way to do that, I had this happen in a campaign, was that the character suddenly discovers that he's been a ringer all along, and that at the beginning of one game where the players were evil cabinet ministers in a futuristic America, one of the characters, none of us knew this was going to happen at the beginning of that night's play, discovered that he was actually an alien lizard in disguise and betrayed them all at the end and had millions of people killed. And escaped, basically, and escaped in a spaceship at the end of the thing. So the other thing is, trust the dynamic of the story to make interesting things happen improvisationally. I think you were you first? Go.
I've used ringers a bunch of times to support story, and it works really well. And it's a great way to get to do illusionism, to get information into to the players without the rest of them knowing that it's actually happening. I actually was a ringer a couple months ago when there was a problem in a mystery where the DM was complaining that the party just couldn't get a clue, you know. So I said, well, tell me what the clue is, and I'll make sure we get it. And no, none of the other players knew that I did it.
So you were a helpful ringer.
Yeah. But I think you could do that very well to support your teams.
I'm going to toss it actually kind of almost in the reverse of that. You also sometimes have the problem, at least I have, where every player loves having a second agenda and a secret plot. And you have six players, and they're all going to betray each other. So halfway through the sixth session, someone starts assassinating someone else while someone else is blowing the building up everyone else is in, except none of them are really there. They're all duplicates, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And it gets into a clusterfuck of these different
plots. You can have mine.
That no one knows are going on.
Well, yeah, obviously, first of all, we need a gamer exchange program where we train our dysfunctional players between groups and balance them.
Damn heroes on my life.
Right.
How do you deal with that sort of complexity?
At one time, funny trick to play would be to have them all discover at the last minute that they're all secretly working together and had no idea that all of their secret agendas converge. But, I mean, basically that's a, sort of a meta-level thing of how do we... Obviously, the players all have a desire to be sneaky and to betray someone. So the way to do that is say, well, why don't we all betray someone together, right? So why don't you be the moles in SD6 or whatever? And so they want to be sneaky and backstabby, and you want them to be unified. So give them somebody else, you know, because, you know, NPCs are disposable people. Create a situation that allows them to enjoy that vicarious thrill of backstabbery. Without, you know, mulching your narrative coherence completely.
The other way to get villains to cooperate, kind of tell them, well, the world's going to end.
Pam, yeah.
That one works pretty well.
Any other questions or comments? Yes?
This is just a question as a player rather than as a DM. How do you deal with the player who is the antithesis of the narrative? Like, he treats the... game as a science rather than alchemy, like you said. Like, he insists on, he's proud of being called a ruler, he's disinterested in the storyline except when he has to do with himself, and he even gets in arguments with the GM saying you're doing it wrong, or he's willing to throw other his fellow teammates under the bus when his alignment says otherwise.
This character's always barred.
Not in 3.5. Bards suck in 3.5, so power gamers aren't going to be a... some of these are, as a player, it would be a matter of you having to talk to the GM aside and say, look, we're getting really frustrated with this guy's dysfunctional play. Let's find ways to channel the things that he wants to do in a way that are positive for everybody else. So, and then result in a negotiation, perhaps an intervention, shall we say, that recognizes that you're not going to change that person's, what that person enjoys, and as we all know from real life, you can't change people into the people we want them to be. You can just sort of adjust the arrangement and the ground rules under which they are that person. So it's fine and good if you're all just rules-focused, But you can't choose to torque. I mean, the whole problem with the alignment system is that people use it as a chance to play selfishly. It's like, well, it's logical that I would fuck you all over because I'm evil.
Code of conduct.
It's like, well, you know, that's it's logical, but it's no fun for everyone. So it's okay if you're a superpower gamer guy, and we're gonna enlist you to tune up our characters as well, so that we can be on a level with you. But you know, you have to play in a team spirit. We're not gonna make you play the emotional scenes. We're gonna rely on you for, you know, your memory of the rules. And then there's the old, you know, I like to argue the rules during playtime. GM, okay, so you have to get your GM to follow the following technique, which is any rules argument has a 90-second expiry date. You can argue for 90 seconds. I'm going to decide, make a provisional ruling at the end of 90 seconds. And at the end of the game, if you want to argue about that some more, we can establish a permanent rule. But during play, it's 90 seconds long and we decide to move on. And quite often, at the end of play, that player doesn't want to argue because that's not the point. They're being selfish and dysfunctional and trying to leverage their personal advantages to attain personal power over everybody else in the room.
So I've found in a lot of games that once you start actually killing things, it just becomes like, okay, now I roll and then I move this person. So do you do anything special in your games to try to like keep the story going through all the crunchy bits?
Depending on the game, if the game is about the crunchy bits, if it's 4E, that's what it's supposed to be. It's story with intervals of tactical interaction.
Could you repeat that for me one more time?
Sorry, repeat what?
The phrase that you just said with the part about 4E.
Stories with intervals of tactical what?
You said something
crunchy. Oh, crunchy bits.
Yeah, with 4E being all crunchy bits. Is that... I was just making sure I heard that.
Right. Yeah. So it's a very crunchy game. It's got all these rules. It's got all these tactical elements. Yeah.
Can I quote you on it?
Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
Good. All right.
I think the people
listening
to the
coach
would be very disappointed if they thought their game had no crunchy bits in it.
You'd be surprised.
You can let those scenes be those scenes if that's what the game is supposed to be, or you can play a more narrative freewheeling style game where the combat, you know, is inherently more narration and story oriented, whether that's Feng Shui or HeroQuest or Gumshoe, or you know, that's when I design games of combat systems, that's how they tend to be. Other ways to do it is to make sure that the fight has a narrative stake, so that not just whether they win or not, because that's sort of a foregone conclusion that they're going to win most of the time, but if you have to kill the orcs over here by the end of round two, and that will enable you to achieve this story goal involving the mayor, so that there's a dramatic tie-in between the story elements and then the tactical moments. And I think we're cruising toward the end of our time, so before I thank you all for your fabulous attendance and wonderful questions, I'd like to remind you that Hamlet's Hit Points is available at the IPR booth and at the Adventure Retail booth. I will be doing a signing for 1 hour on Saturday at 4. If you want to get it signed, I have a really...
That's at the IPR booth.
That's at the IPR booth.
2339, I think.
The dedication for this one is, I think, a sterling piece of writing in itself, so pick that up if you can. Otherwise, it'll be available through retail, it'll be available electronically, and if you want to come by and get me at some other time, I'll mostly be during floor hours at the Pellgrane booth, and would be happy to sign that book or any other book that I've worked on, and happy to stop and chat. So thank you all so very much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Attention now?
Yes.
All right. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone, where we don't know what we're talking
about. Hey, we do know what we're talking about. You know, we called the whole Hugo Weaving Red Skull thing, remember?
Oh, right. Fine. Where was it? The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about all kinds of gaggles of...
Aaron, could you cut it with the gaggles thing? It's not working for me.
All right. Fine. The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games.
Hey, don't forget that we talk about, you know, Bruce Campbell and Christopher Lee, obviously.
Natalie Portman.
All right, guys! I'm trying to do a commercial for the Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games, tabletop gamings, all kinds of other geek stuff.
You mean that show we broadcast on Ustream?
Yes!
Wednesday, 8 Central Standard Time.
Right, at redphonezone.com. Now, can you guys just give me a minute to get this promo done?
Sure. Sorry, dude.
Yeah.
All right, from the top. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone.
Hey, Aaron, we need a tiebreaker. Okay, who would win in a fight with Galactus?
Anti-Monitor.
Galactus and Anti-Monitor. Come on.
I think the more important question would be who would win in a fight between me and you two idiots.
I guess we don't know what we're talking about.
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.